Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Happy fall, right? Keep your fingers crossed. If we say that too loud, Mother Nature could get offended and slam us back into the hundreds, right? Well, today is September 10th, and 1 month ago today, I celebrated 30 years in practice as a licensed professional counselor, licensed marriage and family therapist, and a little more recently, within the last 6 years, a certified sexual therapist. So for 22 years, I was the counseling director at Fellowship Bible Church, Dallas, and then the last 8 years in private practice. Now, if you add up probably 30 to 35 clients a week for 50 weeks out of the year, take 2 weeks off for vacation, right? Times 30 years, you come up with, I probably met one-on-one with 45,000 to 50,000 individuals, one-on-one, in my office through 30 years. It doesn't mean I'm an expert. It does mean I have a lot of experience. So when Steve said, hey, we're doing a series on marriage, and would you do one out of four? I said, sure. And I pondered and thought, gee, out of my 30 years experience, what might I share that's relevant to help us and encourage us about marriage? At least two things came to mind, and these are preliminary to get to my main point, but here's a couple of thoughts that I had. I said, I've got to say these if we're going to talk about marriage. Number one, marriage, when you think about it, is a people-growing machine. It's a people-growing machine. Now think about this. Two people fall in love, very unique, talented, different, lovely individuals. And this attraction glue brings them together, and at some point on their journey, it's going to hit one of them or both of them. Wait a minute. I did not marry me. I married somebody, so not me. Oh my gosh. What was I thinking? I married not me. If only I could get this person to be me, we would be happy. Does that make sense? And somewhere on this journey, as they struggle with this, it also hits them, because this verse was quoted at their marriage ceremony, two shall become one. And it hits them. If two shall become one, which one? Right? I mean, it's got to be one or the other, doesn't it? And because they're very different, and they come together and love brings them together, naturally, this is all what all human beings do, they enter into a massive power struggle, each to influence and change the other. Why? Because it's so difficult to make room for two in this committed relationship, two people who are so uniquely different and see the world differently and do things differently. Spenders marry savers, right? Risk takers usually wind up with non-risk takers. Talkers marry listeners. Extroverts usually wind up with introverts. You get the idea? And there enters in this powerful power struggle, and sooner or later they're each going to say, honey, if you would just see it this way and do it this way, we'd be happy. Now, did you notice the we term? If you do it this way, we would be happy. But there's this tension, and it's there, and this is why marriage is this people-changing, growing machine. It's almost like they're saying, look, I love you. You're wonderful. Now change. This is what all human beings go through. Now, my job as a therapist is to help people channel all of this tension and this ways of doing life differently and channel this into a constructive direction so they can each make room for two in a relationship and love each other. Now, nobody should say when they get married, hey, look, you knew this about me before we got married. This is the way I am. Get over it. Right? Now, we're all tempted to say that. It's like, it's your fault. Your eyes were wide open. What were you thinking of? Don't blame this on me. You knew this about me, right? That's part of marriage. Okay, so preliminary point. Marriage is a people growing machine. When you get married, you probably got to grow. Instead of changing the other person, you have to grow and develop your undeveloped areas in your life. Okay, second point. Marriage, we understand, is a unique relationship. What do I mean by unique? Well, it's a long-term, emotionally committed relationship. It includes intimacy, attraction, and desire. These factors separate marriage from every other relationship that we'll ever have with anybody else on the face of the earth. Attraction, desire, commitment. That's why people take vows. By taking vows, they commit themselves to God, themselves, and to the other. To separate this relationship and make it different than any other relationship they're going to have with anybody else on the face of the earth. By doing so, the New Testament says they're making it holy. They're setting it apart. They're making it special. So, I know that we tend to say, hey, everybody at work likes me. They think I'm funny, right? To which our spouse says, they're not married to you. Right? My friends like me. They have fun with me. We get along great. Talk, connect. The comeback, they're not married to you. My family, my parents, cousins, aunts, and uncles, they love me unconditionally. Yeah, they're not married to you. We got some conditions here. Right? So marriage is a unique relationship. It's like God has thrown two very interesting, wonderful, loving people into a pressure cooker. Now, do you use a pressure cooker? Did you grow up with a pressure cooker? I did. So the idea is to take half a cup of water, put this roast in there, a tough piece of meat, right? Clamp the lid on top, put it on the stove, heat the burner up. What happens? Pressure builds. You know that little relief valve on top? If that wasn't there, what would happen? Oh, the whole thing would blow up. Well, it's like God has taken two very unique, different, wonderful, loving people, thrown them into this pressure cooker called marriage, clamped the lid down through vows and commitments, and this whole thing is generating a lot of tension to transform us. Go figure. Isn't that amazing? What a process. So what happens is, when we're in this pressure cooker, it seems like it's God's design that weak, undeveloped areas in our life have a way of surfacing through all this pressure of living with somebody so different than we ourselves. All the weak, undeveloped areas in our life surface. So this helps us answer the question, why is it in marriage that it seems like the person we care about the most, love the most, who is the most significant to us, why at times do we treat that person the worst? Because all these other relationships don't bring these weak areas out of us. Your parents, you left them. Bye, see ya. They said, see ya. Right when you have work, right? Friends, you don't live with them. Roommates, you can get a new roommate. So, in this unique relationship, areas of our life are revealed. We mistakenly think it caused it in us. Actually, our spouse didn't cause these weak things and these bad behaviors in us. The pressure of the relationship evoked and revealed our already undeveloped areas, because maybe we've never been married to somebody for a long time or been in a relationship like this. We don't have the skill sets, and it's all going to come out. That's when I say in therapy, everything is going right. It's not going wrong. Does that make sense? I just have to help people grow through it. It's going right. It's not going wrong. So when I work with couples, here's a question that I begin my marriage therapy with. It's just a question for them to each to consider. Here it is. I say, in this relationship, would you rather be put up with, endured, and tolerated, and loved for Jesus' sake? Or would you like the person you're married to have attraction and desire in their heart and like you? Which would you prefer? Because what I find is if couples or individuals in my office say, really, the first question, I don't care. Tolerate me, endure me, put up with me. I don't care. Once a person doesn't care in their heart if the other person likes them or not, they usually have worse behaviors because they don't care. Why would they care? And when they stop caring, guess what the other person does? Stops caring. So now I have two people who don't care, and it's going to bring out the worst in them because they have worse behaviors because they don't care. They have no reason to hedge their bad behavior. They don't care if the other person likes them in their heart. But if you do care, they care to be liked, they'll have better behaviors. Because if we want to be liked by somebody, it's nice to have good behaviors, good attitudes, so they'll like us. That's the way life is. But when people get married, they think, I don't have to do any of that. You just got to like me and put up with me unconditionally, without condition, and you have to give me the love. Now, that's not the way marriage works. To be loved, you've got to be a really good person and have good behaviors and find the value, because you want the other person to have attraction in their heart. Okay, so let's look at a scripture, because we're answering the question, what keeps desire and attraction alive in a long-term emotionally committed relationship? That's the focus. That's why I say to people, do you want that? Do you want the other person to like you in their heart? Sure you do. Then let's look at this passage in Luke. Luke chapter 18, 9 through 12. And you'll get the idea, and then we'll tie it into marriage. It says, and he, Jesus, also told this parable to some people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous. And they viewed others with contempt. So here's the parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray. One a Pharisee, religious person. The other a tax collector. Now the Pharisee stood and was praying this to himself. Now whether he was saying this out loud or whether this was in his heart doesn't make any difference. The Pharisee stood and was praying, God, I thank you. I'm not like other people. Swindlers, unjust, adulterers, and even like this tax collector guy over here. Thank the Lord I'm not like him. I fast twice a week, pretty religiously observant, because I love God. And on top of it, I pay tithes of all that I get. I give back to God. So this is his position. This is his attitude in the temple. And let's remember the purpose that Jesus is telling us. He says, look, some people have a soapbox, and they get up on the soapbox, and from that soapbox, they look down on others. Now, pause just a moment. Take a time out. Don't go to sleep. What's the soapbox this guy is standing on that enables him to look down from a higher position? His soapbox is, there are less things wrong about him, he says, than others. He doesn't do this. He doesn't do this. He's not like this. There are less imperfections, he says, less flaws, less sin, less bad behavior. Now, he's more right he says ethically. And his high ground allows him to say, I am better than and higher than everybody else. So I can look down from my high position. He says, I'm not a swindler. I'm not a con man. I'm not going to take your money. I am not unjust. I will give you a fair deal if you do business with me. I'm not a cheater. I'm faithful in my marriage. Nothing's going on. There's no sexual indiscretions. And in our terminology, I'm not going to strip clubs. There's no internet pornography. And most of all, I'm not like this guy over here, the tax collector. You know, he makes his living working for the Roman government, and he makes a commission on every tax that he turns in. He makes a commission, so he overcharges, and we don't like him. I'm not like that guy. He's lying in his pockets. I go to church. I give money to the church. I don't drink. And if I do, I don't get drunk. I don't use drugs. I don't get angry. I don't yell at people. I'm not this. I'm not this. I'm not this. I'm not like that. I'm not like that. I'm not like that. It almost reminds me of the old Saturday Night Live skit. No, doggone it. I'm good enough. I'm smart enough. And doggone it, people like me. Remember that? Stuart Smalley? Al Franken. Now, three things. This guy has very little self-awareness. Now, he's aware of everybody else, right? He's not like everybody else, but he has very little self-awareness. He doesn't see his own imperfections. He's comparing himself to others. And he has a very self-serving process, very self-selective. I'm not like that guy and that guy. Well, what about that guy over there? What about that one? No, he's picking out the ones that he's better than and comparing himself. Very little personal ownership of any imperfection in his own life because he doesn't see any. So how can he own something that he doesn't see? So this means he can rationalize his behavior. I mean, if he does something wrong, he can say, hey, you started it. He can rationalize it. He can minimize his behavior. Normally, I'm not this way, but when you walk in the room, I just responded that way. It wasn't that bad. Minimize. He can excuse it, blame shift it, and he can justify his behavior in his heart. He has very little personal ownership. And last, thirdly, he lacks humility, which is the point of the parable. He doesn't see his own flaws, very little self-awareness, very little personal ownership, very little humility. Now, by contrast, let's look at the tax collector. Jesus says, but this tax collector, who was standing some distance away, was unwilling to even lift up his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, not just a sinner, not just an average imperfect person, the sinner. God, I'm able to see myself. God, I am in need of your mercy, grace, forgiveness, as I see clearly who I am. He demonstrates self-awareness, personal ownership, and he has humility. So Jesus says, I tell you, this man went to his house justified. For everyone who exalts himself on a soapbox will one day be humbled. But he who humbles himself will be exalted. Now notice what the tax collector, by contrast, does and doesn't do as compared to the Pharisee. He doesn't compare himself to others. He doesn't say, hey, I'm focusing on you, 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 and you, and you, and you, and you, and I'm better than you. I've seen you. I'm better than that. He really is not having an other person focus. He's looking at his own life first and foremost. He says, I see me. I see. And he says, standing off a distance away, He's not even willing to look and raise his eyes to heaven because he sees how imperfect he is. He doesn't say, I'm not as bad as that person or that person. He doesn't say, well, at least I haven't done that behavior. I know you have. He doesn't say, I obviously don't do the bad things that all of those people are doing. He just says, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Just me. He says, I have enough personal imperfections and flaws on my own plate to worry about. I can't worry about yours or compare myself to yours. I have to look only at my own. And by doing so, he takes ownership of his imperfections. He doesn't blame. He doesn't rationalize. He doesn't minimize. He doesn't excuse his behavior. He takes 100% responsibility before God. By doing so, he says, please forgive me. Not forgive them. And by doing so, he has humility. It's my own fault, he says. I don't have a leg to stand on. I know this. I own this. This is about me and not about others. I don't blame them, and I don't justify my own behavior. So he demonstrates humility and lowers himself. Now, time out just a moment. Pause with me just for a moment. Could we just agree this is not a pleasant experience? He's struggling. He sees himself. It's disruptive. The Pharisee took the easy way and says, I don't see any of it. It's not about me, frankly. It's about y'all, and I'm better than this, and I know it. He's not wrestling very much with what's going on inside of him. This guy is. I'm reminded of a quote by C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity. C.S. Lewis says, Christian religion, in the long run, is a thing of unspeakable comfort. But it does not begin in comfort. It begins in dismay. And no one can arrive at the comfort without having first gone through the dismay. Now, what's he talking about? The dismay is the disruption of we each and all have to see ourselves first before we can receive forgiveness and mercy. There is no shortcut. Do you remember when Jesus says in another place in the New Testament, he who is forgiven much loves much. Remember that? He who is forgiven little loves little. Why? To be forgiven much, we first must go through dismay and disruption and see ourselves, to see our imperfection and to feel the burden of it and the weight of it, then be in need of grace, mercy, and forgiveness, out of which we love much because we've been forgiven much. But people who refuse to see their own life don't need to be forgiven for anything. And if they are extended grace, it's called cheap grace because they trample on it because it's cost-free to them. They didn't have to see anything about their life. They just received the goodness. But it doesn't make them good lovers. That's the point. This guy has humility. He sees it. He has self-awareness, ownership. This is a guy you can go to dinner with. Here's my point. Let me tie it all together. What does this have to do with marriage? Here it is. In my 30 years, the privilege of meeting with people, I've never seen conflict in and of itself between people destroy love. I've never seen differences between people destroy love because people are different. They see the world differently. Remember, you did not marry you. I've never seen differences between people destroy love. Let me go up a stage now. I've never seen overt sin, transgression, wrongdoing and overt bad behavior in and of itself destroy love. Here's what destroys love. Lack of self-awareness. You don't really understand how you impact the people you say you love. Lack of personal ownership. A lot of blame shifting, minimizing, excusing, and justifying behavior. And lack of humility. If these three things are present, the person you're in a relationship with has to endure you and tolerate you. They're struggling to like you in their heart. But once there's ownership, increased awareness, and humility, they like you, even though you're imperfect, because you are aware, your eyes are open, you have ownership and humility. You become a likable person in that moment, even though imperfect. But it's not a pleasant experience, right? So let me tie it together. Let me tell you about Tom and Mary. Now, Tom and Mary is a compilation of many people that I've met with. All right? So don't worry. If you go to see Billy, you're not going to wind up as a sermon illustration. People worry about that. Trust me. When I first met with Tom and Mary, it became clear to me that really Tom had gotten into a habit over time of organizing the majority of his thoughts, attitudes, actions, and behaviors around the number one goal of influencing and changing Mary. Make sense? Now, this is not uncommon. But Tom had kind of organized a lot of his life around the goal of teaching, correcting, and influencing Mary. And Tom began the way most people begin. He began complaining about Mary to Mary. It's not uncommon. People do this. So he was attempting to use negatives about Mary to get Mary to respond positively. Time out. Just think about that. Does something about that just not make sense? That the more you can be negative about a human being to that human being, the more you can be negative to them, they're supposed to positively respond and make positive changes. Right? But that's what we do. So Tom would say, Mary, you're always late. I could give you all the time in the world to get ready, and you'd still be late. I'm so tired of this. I could give you hours and hours and hours of advance notice, put it on the schedule. You would still find a way to be late. Now, to add icing on the cake to this negative quality about Mary, Tom would then attack her character and assign it to her character. Mary, that behavior is insensitive and rude, and you are insensitive and rude. Now, this is normal human behavior. I don't think it's wise. I understand it. Because Tom was using negatives about Mary, about being late, and he was not seeing results that this was effectively changing Mary, he added a little icing on the cake by attaching it to her character, which is a nice way of saying, you're just selfish and disrespectful, and this is how you are and who you are. Because see, he wasn't getting behavioral change with go-round number one, so he upped the ante. Now, do you really think that motivates a human being to become more positive or to become more negative? Of course. I'll get to Mary's response in a moment. Tom would say, what exactly you've been doing all day? I come home and the house is a mess. There's stuff everywhere and the place is chaotic and the kids are out of control. Thanks, Tom. Then he had to add a little extra. I work hard all day and extra hours to provide for you and this family, and you act like you don't even care. Now, to add a little zinger, because this wasn't working, Tom then had to say, and your response, Mary, is disrespectful, And sometimes I wonder, is all this even worth it? Not wise, Tom. Of course, when Mary would hear Tom say these things, she did what normal people do. What do normal people do? Do they respond with, oh my gosh, I didn't know. I absolutely will make these changes. Thanks for sharing. That makes sense for me. I'm so happy to be married to the Holy Spirit. Thank you for being in my life. No, of course not. Mary waited patiently, and then Mary did what normal people do. She had a defense back and a counterpunch, because Tom is married to a good sparring partner. So Mary would say, well, I'm not always late. So she's keying in on the word always. Yes, it takes me longer to get ready, but you've been late sometimes. I'm not the only one. You were late the other day. So now she's going to find one day out of 100 that Tom was late, and she's going to serve it up to Tom, because Mary's creative. She's a good sparring partner. And she says, I'm doing the best I can with the house and the kids. It's overwhelming to keep up with while taking care of two young children. And then she would add the little zinger, because she had a defense, now she's got a counterpunch. Compared to what I face every day, your job is easy. Man. So far, the score is Tom 3, Mary 2 in my office, right? We're keeping score on the chalkboard, right? And then here's her third point. And talk about someone who doesn't care. You, my friend, are the king of not caring. You don't take initiative with the birthdays. You don't care to make those special. You never take me out. So why should I care? Punch, counterpunch. Now you can understand this way of relating could go on for hours, and sometimes does in my office, and I can't get a word in edgewise. I'm just a referee throwing a 15-yard penalty flag, which nobody even pays attention to. So as I began to work with them, I had to gain some space, had Tom in my office over a good period of time, 6 to 8 weeks, by himself, and I needed to make a shift away from him trying to influence and change Mary, and Mary trying to counter-influence and change Tom. I had to increase Tom's self-awareness, increase his personal ownership, and give up the goal of trying to change Mary. Now, there came a time in my office, in working with Tom, I had to help Tom see, Tom, every time you make this negative movement towards Mary, she has a negative movement back, and then you blame her for the very behavior that you helped initiate inside of her. You disown your own behavior, and you focus on her bad response back. That's very creative. It just won't work. Why would Mary ever give in to that? Why, Tom? Let it go. Give it up. Why don't you just accept Mary as Mary is? And let's pay attention to your own behaviors, your own self-awareness, and personal ownership, because in life, we are responsible to anything in our life. We are responsible for our response. Right? Somebody yells at us, we're responsible for our response. Tom, you're letting yourself off the hook. There came a day in my office, over 6 to 8 weeks of working with Tom. Tom had resistance. Tom had some fight with this, but he came to see the truth of it. And one day he sat in the office and he said this, truly, genuinely, sincerely, from his heart, Mary, I see that for a long time in our relationship, I've spent the majority of my energy on trying to teach, change, and correct you. And I do it by being negative, critical, griping, and complaining. And when that doesn't work, I punch a little harder. Mary, that's on me. That's not about you. When you give me your responses back, I blamed you for those. That's on me. This is mostly about me. And I see it. I see it clearly. I had a guy, Tom, told me in front of Mary. He said, you know, when Billy described what I was doing, I had such resistance, Mary. I have come to see my own behavior as uncalled for, unloving, and really intolerable. I don't blame you or fault you in any way for your responses back to me. Mary, most of this is about me and my intolerance, my lack of patience, and my lack of love. You are not the cause of this in my life. You've revealed what's in my life, and I've blame shifted it on you and others. I see this about me. This is about my own failure, period. No yes buts. There is no hidden agenda, Mary. I want to learn to be more understanding and more loving and take responsibility for my life and not be the expert on your life. I'm sorry for the hurt that I've caused you. I don't fault you or blame you at all. I'm not easy to love. Now, in that one moment, which took a long time getting to, Tom went from being a person you tolerate and endure, put up with, because he couldn't see his intolerable behaviors. In this one moment, he went from that to being a very attractive human being. In that moment, I really liked Tom in my heart. He wasn't a guy I was just working with. I'd go to dinner with that guy. You know, it's easier in marriage to fight with your spouse than it is to fight with ourselves. Do you know fighting with our spouse a lot of times is just a way out to not face fighting with ourselves before God? So couples in my office will be fighting, because nobody wants to drop their end of the rope. Do you know the day Tom dropped his end of the rope to bring Mary to the bar of justice, what was his biggest fear? That Mary would never change, right? Because he was going to bring her to the bar of justice. I kept telling Tom, the more you try to change Mary, Mary's going to fight you. And she probably should. Tom, let it go. Fight with yourself before God. Only take a look at your own life and be humble. The day Tom did that was the day it gave room for Mary to consider her own life. Because she didn't have to fight with Tom as much. And she was suspicious. Is this Tom's other ploy to try to change me? I said, Mary, test it out. Over time, test it out. And she did. And Tom remained true on the journey. And after a while, Mary began to wrestle with her own life and her own responses and who she really was in their relationship before God. As a result of giving up their goal of changing each other, they actually came closer together and they actually liked each other. That's what the parable is talking about. Mary had less to fight and defend, and she began to make room for herself. So both people then increased their self-awareness. They increased their personal ownership. And they had a wonderful sense of humility. They actually started to like each other. They became better people. Because they gave up the goal of trying to change each other to have a better relationship. So Jesus says in the parable, whoever humbles himself will be exalted. Exalted in so many ways. People will like you in their heart, even though you're not perfect. You'll have grace, mercy, love, kindness given to you. Resist it. Put ourselves high on a platform and try to bring people to the bar of justice and change them. Kills attraction and desire. Then people tolerate us. I don't know that they like us in their heart. Take this humbly. Meditate on it. It is the path to keep attraction and desire alive. in a long-term relationship. Pray with me. Father, we humbly understand this is about each of us and all of us. We have ways of not seeing ourselves. We have ways of behaving, and other people respond back to us, and then we only focus on their response. And we get mad at their response. We blame them. And we never see our contribution. We minimize, we justify, we excuse, and then only focus on them and complain. Help us reverse this, to see ourselves, to own our own behaviors, and to be humble, and thus really be liked by people that we desire to be liked by. In Christ's name, amen.